KALW.
Even though she has a 6-year term, from the very beginning, she's kind of been in election mode, knowing that this recall would happen.
Pamela Price ran for Alameda County District Attorney on a platform of restorative justice.
She was kind of a lightning rod, but there have been several controversies since then.
Today we hear about the accusations of extortion that she's facing. Then we'll hear Price's response to those allegations.
This is really a referendum on Alameda County. This is not about me.
Plus, San Francisco voters will decide on an expansion to the city's affordable housing program.
If we could build more of these type of subsidized senior housing, it would be the best thing, best gift.
A discussion on Prop G. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Well, it's 7 days to the election. While the presidential race is filling our feeds, locally, there's a lot going on that Bay Area residents are following. Today, we'll start in the East Bay, where Alameda County District Attorney Pamela Price faces a recall election next week, less than 2 years after taking office. The former civil rights attorney was elected in 2022, and almost immediately, Price became the focus of a series of controversies. Now she's being accused of attempting to extort a $25,000 contribution from Mario Juarez, an East Bay businessman. To further complicate this narrative, Juarez is a key figure in an ongoing federal probe into government corruption in Oakland, which involved an FBI raid of Mayor Sheng Tao's home. For more on the controversy involving Alameda County's embattled DA, KLW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke with Nathan Gartrell, a reporter for the East Bay Times.
There's a whole lot of stuff at play right now, and it's all kind of, in some ways, converging on this one case. A few months ago, back at the beginning of this year, the Alameda County DA charged a man named Mario Juarez with grand theft, basically for bouncing a check for some political campaign flyers in the mayoral election that basically served to benefit the person who got elected mayor, which of course is Sheng Tao, and because they were attacking her main opponent. Apparently, Juarez agreed to pay a certain amount, and then the check he wrote bounced, and he was charged with a felony, and that case has been pending ever since. And it just so happens this guy, Mario, is a political operative who has been around in the Bay Area for a really long time. He has ties to a lot of politicians. He was even seated next to Bill Clinton for a fundraiser back in 2008. So we have a picture of him back then. You know, he was pretty high up the local Democratic chain for a while. And he's also connected to a lot of, you know, donors and potential straw donors in town, stuff like that. What he's now alleging is that on the very day that the city of Oakland was burying a law enforcement officer who was killed, shot and killed in the line of duty while chasing after a cannabis dispensary burglary crew, after that funeral, he's alleging that he met up with District Attorney Pamela Price and one of her top administrators, and it just so happens that also present that day were members of this family that's currently being investigated by the FBI. And they had this meeting at this Embarcadero office where Price allegedly asked for a $25,000 donation. And Juarez says that when he turned her down, he was charged about a week later. Now, this is a case where the investigation was completed back in mid-2023. So, you know, the fact that he was charged 1 week later after this supposedly happened, that in and of itself is suspicious. But also, this meeting occurred at an office that 5 months later in June was the target of an FBI raid. And not only was this office raided by the FBI, but the mayor's house was raided by the FBI that in the same sweep. And it's widely assumed that Mario Juarez is cooperating in that federal investigation. So you have another layer on top of everything else where, you know, this guy's potentially a federal informant or at least a potential witness against some of the bigger players in this case. But he's also charged with this relatively small thing in Alameda County that at this point is honestly, I think, hurting the district attorney's reputation more than it stands to alter the course of Mario Juarez's life.
A riddle wrapped around an enigma.
Probably one of the most shocking crimes in recent memory in Oakland, on the sort of the backdrop of all this. You have allegations of bribery. You have this family, which, by the way, is in the waste disposal business. So, you know, Sopranos or something.
The largest waste disposal contractor with the city.
Yeah. And the nature of this investigation, from what we're told, has to do with money laundering. It has to do with potential sex trafficking allegations amongst brothels in town and other sort of really old professions, shall we say, that have kind of go to serve the more hedonistic side of human nature, whether it be gambling or prostitution or whatever. No one's been charged yet, but that's sort of what it seems like this investigation is going. And by the way, Mario Juarez, a few days before the FBI raids, somebody very loudly started tampering with his vehicle outside of his East Oakland home. When he went outside, they shot at him and he fired back with his own gun. They left, they came around, they shot up his house a second time in what Oakland police tell us was an attempted assassination. And then the FBI rushes their raids and starts knocking down doors just a few days after that. So there's a whole lot going on behind closed doors right now, and things are really heating up. And, you know, you also, of course, have a recall election coming up, where basically you might see within about 3 weeks from now is Oakland voters could kick out their mayor and Alameda County voters could kick out the DA. So we might have a totally different administration here pretty soon, which also could kind of be occurring around the same time potentially as indictments in this investigation if a grand jury finds enough evidence to issue them. So it's a whole lot going on at once. You know, you talk about like an October surprise or something in an, you know, the late stages of an election. I think there's several, you know, and they all have to do with this same case. You know, and my mom's side of the family is all Italian. I've been hearing these kinds of stories from back in New York my whole life, but I've never actually gotten to cover one in real time. So it's been kind of a treat.
Isn't this the latest controversy? I mean, Pamela Price was chastened by the governor for not taking advantage of prosecutors for serious crimes. She was chastened by an Alameda County Superior Court judge for not furnishing enough documents to charge two police officers, and those charges were dismissed. And of course, she hired her boyfriend by going around loopholes in Oakland's employment system. It seems like when it rains, it pours, at least for the district attorney.
Pamela Price, you know, when she took office, I think law enforcement was planning to try and launch a recall, like police unions and things like that basically hated her from the get-go. And she is kind of the most progressive DA in Northern California, at least, maybe in all of California, although her and George Gascon are probably the number one and number two. You can have your own opinion about who's number one, who's number two. From the very beginning, she was kind of a lightning rod, but there have been several controversies since then, hiring her boyfriend against the advice of some of her political advisors. It kind of looks like nepotism. There was a controversial plea deal involving a guy who was accused of three murders that a judge refused to sign off on. So then her office dismissed two of the murder charges that would have been baked into the plea deal, rather, and then said that they didn't have enough evidence for those. And then they're able to get the deal that they wanted through despite that. But there's a lot of people who were upset about it along the way. There have been any number of protests outside the courthouse and counter protests, by the way, from her supporters. Even though she has a 6-year term, from the very beginning, she's kind of been in election mode, knowing that this recall would happen. And then there was also an instance where she tried to ban a particular journalist who had done some stories quoting people who were very critical of her from a press conference. And then after she got threatened by some First Amendment advocacy groups with potential legal action and widely condemned, she backed down and changed course on that. There's a former public information officer for her office who recently sued her. And one of the allegations was that she was deliberately withholding public records during a public record request from citizens and journalists, and that she kind of flippantly referred to both journalists and Asian Americans as her quote unquote enemies. I think she meant like, you know, political enemies. So we haven't gone more than a month or two without some kind of controversy of some sort. And this is really just the latest thing to come up.
That was reporter Nathan Gartrell. He covers crime and corruption for the East Bay Times. And we just heard his rundown of the controversies surrounding Alameda DA Pamela Price. Next, we'll hear her response. After speaking with Nathan, KLW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke with Price about the recall campaign to unseat her. Here's Sunni.
You're facing a recall election on November 5th. This, I guess, in many ways is a referendum on your first year or so in office. What is your appeal to Alameda County voters? Why do you think you should keep your job?
My appeal to the voters of Alameda County is this is really a referendum on Alameda County. This is not about me. The effort to overturn the November 2022 election started before I got here, the day I got here, and they wanted to turn back the hands of time and reinstall the status quo totally without me. This is not a test for me. It's a test for Alameda County and whether or not we want to continue to move forward. We took a huge step forward in November of 2022. And the question is, do we want to have accountability and integrity in our criminal justice system, or do we want to have racism and disparities? And that's the test for the voters.
Who do you mean by they? Who do you define as they?
Well, the people who lost, number one, they're folks like my predecessor, a lot of people who were in my office who supported the other guy. They were very disappointed and shocked that he lost. And so we know that there were grumblings amongst those folks who lost the election. The leaders of the persons who present on the media, they were very involved in running an election for my opponent in November of 2020, well, throughout 2022. So those are the folks that, you know, were really upset that their candidate lost. A lot of people were upset about that. Apparently, we are now in a season where we have a lot of wealthy people, in particular, one billionaire, Philip Dreyer, who seems particularly interested in overturning or disrupting the governance in Alameda County. And so he spent millions of dollars to finance the effort to recall me, as well as the effort to recall the Oakland mayor.
There have been a string of controversies involving your office going back more than a year, almost to the time that you took office. In July, Governor Newsom was critical of your office and rescinded an offer to send state lawyers to assist in the prosecution of crimes. In October, Alameda County Superior Court Judge Scott Patton dismissed charges against two Alameda police officers in the Gonzalez killing, and said that your office had not filed proper paperwork and that the cases had passed the statute of limitations. So we have the governor of the state of California, we have a superior court judge who has basically criticized your office. What is your response?
I am supported by a portion of community organizations, elected officials. Numerous people have come out in support of the work that we've done here with respect to the state of California. We've been able to settle some of the largest settlements working with the Attorney General's office in the history of the Alameda County. We've also received the largest grant funding for organized retail theft, specifically from the governor's office. We've also received the largest government awarded grant for the CARES Navigation Center, $6 million. So we have been doing a great deal of work, both at the state level, whether it's the governor's office or through the state opportunities available to us. And so the fact that the governor's proposal to send two lawyers to office. We have 152 lawyers in 10 locations. We have over 400 employees. And so they come to work every day to do the work representing the residents of Alameda County. So, and the fact that if a judge criticizes us, well, you know, we have Judges, we got a lot of judges in Alameda County. We got a lot of cases. We processed over, I think it was over 12,000 cases last year. If we have one judge in one case, but that doesn't mean that we are not doing the work and that we do get it right a lot of times. If you look at the string of convictions and charges that we have been able to bring successfully over the last year, the fact that one judge is critical of us or it's in a particular case, I think that people should give us credit for the work that we have done and that we are doing every day. Anytime you're doing work, you're going to get criticized.
That was Pamela Price, Alameda County District Attorney, speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. Election Day is next week. Find all our election coverage. Be informed. Go to KALW.org/2024elections. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. To help Bay Area voters, KALW's been holding panel discussions in San Francisco at 220 Montgomery, our live event space. One conversation explored San Francisco's Prop G, which would dedicate money from the general fund towards rental subsidies for extremely low-income seniors, people with disabilities, and families. If it's approved, it would require the city to spend up to $8.25 million a year, filling the gap between what San Francisco's lowest income residents earn and the deed-restricted affordable housing that's available. So this basically means that an apartment earmarked for people earning 80% of the median income could be rented to a family making only 30%, with the city making up the difference in cost. Our panel on Prop G was hosted by San Francisco Public Press Executive Director Lila LaHood. She spoke with Caroline Feng, who's Chief Community Real Estate Officer at the Mission Economic Development Agency, and Annie Chung, President and CEO at Self Help for the Elderly. Here's Annie explaining how many people would be impacted by Prop G.
The estimate is if this get passed, about 550 units will be subsidized for extremely low-income residents. So that's a lot, because since 2019, only about 90 units were subsidized. So with this Prop G, if passed, and I hope it will pass, that 550 more very low-income elderly and family will benefit.
And can one of you talk about what does it mean to be extremely low-income in San Francisco?
In San Francisco and across the nation, there are kind of these different tiers of income qualifications. And so for someone who is very low income, that means you're earning typically up to 30% of the local median annual income. So in San Francisco, for a single adult, that would be about $26,000 a year, or for a household with four people in it, that would be about $52,450 per year. So we're not talking about a lot of money here.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we can imagine, but Caroline, could you explain maybe why people in this category would have particular trouble finding housing in San Francisco?
Yeah, so I was going to convert those numbers into people.
Thank you.
So it's the seniors, like the seniors with Self-Help for the Elderly, as well as seniors that Meta serves. It's our janitors. It's our paraprofessionals that are in our schools. Those are the folks who we're talking about when we say that we're trying to keep in our housing in San Francisco. And frankly, those are also the folks who we've seen get into homelessness over the last 5 years during the pandemic and before, right before the pandemic, because those are the same folks who, as housing costs have risen, have been on the verge of homelessness. So without having this opportunities for extremely low-income folks to be able to stay in their homes, then we also increase the likelihood of homelessness too.
Annie, could you talk a little bit about how this specifically affects older adults?
It's very important for older adults, particularly elderly over 65, 70, 80 years old, to live in safe, affordable, and viable housing. It really is important to their health, physically and mentally. For very low-income seniors, extremely, we call it ELI, many of our seniors, actually, reality is they get SSI between $1,400 to $1,500 a month. That's it. They don't even make $26,000. So they're like under 15% of the AMI. And these elderly, the Department of Aging estimated that about 42,000 households in San Francisco are extremely low income. So even if we pass Prop G and 550 units get subsidized, there's still literally tens and thousands of elderly will still be waiting. So without it, we're going to even wait even longer. And I think that we didn't know that back in 2019, when the other housing bond, $600 million, was passed, at that time, we thought that low-income seniors automatically will qualify. But I was very surprised when I joined the campaign that extremely low-income seniors, they don't even reach the threshold to apply. So they were totally kept out of the affordable housing. So that's when we start really advocating for a separate funding for extremely low-income seniors so that the project developers could get them financed, you know, by lowering the admission rate to lower than 35, 20, even 15%.
I think this is an important thing to emphasize because when members of the public hear that this is, you know, low-income housing, I think they maybe think it means everyone below a certain level. But as you pointed out, there is a minimum threshold of income in order to participate in some of these programs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Madison, you have recently done some reporting on adults with disabilities. And have you had a chance to talk to people in the community about this measure in particular, or, you know, housing affordability needs and how they may be addressed by this?
Yeah, so I think that housing affordability for older adults has been a huge area of focus, and just so many of the people that I talk to, like Annie said, are living on really limited incomes, and then you factor in the cost of things like medical care, food. I mean, when you think about living off of $1,400 a month, that is really nothing. And then a lot of the base rent for housing that's supposedly affordable is nowhere near what those folks can afford. So I think that people are really, really pressing for more affordable options. And I think a lot of folks are super excited. At a recent hearing at the Board of Supervisors, or meeting at the Board of Supervisors, there were dozens and dozens of people that came out and voiced their support for this measure. And we're just talking about how difficult it is for them to afford living in San Francisco. Many of them were families who are living in single room occupancy hotels. It's four people in a room that's, you know, teeny, teeny, tiny. And so the impact that being able to afford to have your rent subsidized by a measure like this for folks like that would be huge.
And then for adults with disabilities, they may have additional needs where even housing that's available might not accommodate their needs.
Yeah.
Okay, so this program would be managed by the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. How did this happen, and is this the right entity to be managing this program, or do you have other thoughts on that?
I mean, we've been working with the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development to help develop the housing, and then separately, the city has multiple other agencies that put out the subsidies. What we found is then we've got this Byzantine system for our households, whether or not they're families or they're seniors or they're youth that are emancipated, trying to navigate where do we get all these subsidies. So in some ways, having the subsidies at the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development puts more direct connections between the folks who also manage the dollars that go into building the housing with then where are we going to get the operational dollars to support families who may not otherwise be able to afford the rent into one single place. And hopefully some of this makes it a little less, as as we do that, it simplifies it a lot more for our households who are trying to look for the housing too.
So you see it as an opportunity for better coordination?
Yes. That was a simpler way of saying what I said. Yes, exactly.
Annie, do you have anything to add on that?
We built our first affordable senior housing back in 1990. And it was the best thing that happened because there was the HUD 202 project that you could apply the program. And they subsidize 66% because our residents only pay 30% of their income as rent. And for the past 34 years, you know, my residents and my seniors told me that it's really getting winning the lottery to move into Lady Shaw is better than winning the real lottery because they lived in a really safe and then almost permanently subsidized house. They only pay, if they're on SSI, their rent is under $300. And I think that if we could build more of these type of subsidized senior housing for San Francisco residents, elderly, older adults, families, and people with disability, it would be the best thing, best gift.
Those were the voices of Annie Chung, CEO at Self Help for the Elderly, Caroline Feng from the Mission Economic Development Agency, and reporter Madison Alvarado with the San Francisco Public Press. The panel was hosted by their executive director, Lila LaHood. And they talked about a whole lot more. You can hear the full conversation at klw.org/2024elections. Today's Cross Currents team includes James Rollins, Ganadijo Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shireen Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.